You are Locked On Orioles, your daily podcast on the Baltimore Orioles, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Locked On Orioles, your place for Orioles news, analysis, and everything else from the clubhouse to the warehouse and beyond. As always, I'm your host, Justin McGuire. Guys, as I record this, the Orioles have just fallen 8-4 to the Tampa Bay Rays, and they now stand at 6-18 on the season. They have lost 12 of their last 14 games, and frankly, I'm running out of ways to say that this is a lousy baseball team. With that in mind, I've decided not to talk about the 2018 Orioles today. Instead, we're going to take a look back to Orioles history and take a look at the 1970 Orioles with author Mark Armore, who's here to talk about a book that he put together a few years ago called Pitching, Defense, and Three-Run Homers. We'll get to that in just a second. Hey folks, just a reminder, for all the original content of the Locked On Podcast Network, both the podcasts and the written content on every team, go to LockedOnSports.com. And of course, for all your content on the Baltimore Orioles, make sure to go to LockedOnOrioles.com. Hey everybody, welcome back to Locked On Orioles. We are joined now by Mark Armore. He is the co-editor of a book called Pitching, Defense, and Three-Run Homers, the 1970 Baltimore Orioles. And he helped put this together a few years ago for SABR, the Society for American Baseball Research. So Mark, first thing I wanted to ask you, the 2018 Orioles are going to be terrible, so I thought it'd be fun to talk about the 1970 Orioles. In your opinion, were the 1970 Orioles the greatest team in Orioles history?
Yes. I hadn't thought about it before, but yeah, I think so. I think that, honestly, they're one of the better teams in all of history. I would say they're a top 10 team, probably. I mean, they had everything, and it was a time, you know, this is beyond your question, but it was a time when everybody who followed baseball looked up to the Orioles as sort of the gold standard.
Yeah, and that you talk about that in the book, and there's a few quotes in there that just kind of are, let's just say they're hard to fathom as a from the perspective of 2018, because not only are the Orioles bad this year, but it's been a long time since they were the gold standard for anything. And one thing you talk about in the book, and this is something I remember from when I was a kid, and just so people know, I am not old enough to remember the 1970 Orioles. I was alive, but I was only I turned 2 years old that summer, so I don't remember the Orioles of 1970. Of course, I've read about them a lot over the years. But one thing I do remember that was still a thing that people talked about in the late 70s and early 80s when I was first becoming aware of the Orioles is something called the Oriole Way. So could you just describe to people who are too young to remember, what was the Oriole Way?
Well, the Oriole Way, I mean, really probably the first way that really, you know, people sort of talked about was the Dodgers. And there's a guy named Al Campanis that became infamous later on for some things he said. But he actually wrote a book called The Dodger Way to Play Baseball. And it was largely sort of, it was instructional. But they codified how baseball was sort of taught throughout the entire organization. And the Orioles sort of took that on in, like, I think it started even in, like, in the late 50s with Paul Richards, and then throughout the 60s with Harry Dalton, who was the farm director for the team for several years before he became the GM in 1966. And basically, the Orioles had a way that every position was taught. They had a way that every pitcher was taught to pitch and work out and exercise and train. They had a way that scouts were going to look for players. They basically were one of the first teams, maybe the second team after the Dodgers, that took on the notion of an organizational-wide philosophy for instruction and coaching and scouting. And the gold standard that I'm talking about is that everyone believed, when I was a kid, and sounds like I'm about 7 years older than you, that the Orioles were the team that everyone wanted to be like, not just at the major league level, but also in the organization, and which is why All of the Orioles coaches ended up becoming managers. Many of the Orioles players from this team ended up being managers as well. And I think it's because everybody thought that that's where the smart people were.
Right. And of course, you know, Davey Johnson's one of the players who was on this team who went on to be a very successful manager. You know, George Bamberger, Billy Hunter, a lot of these guys went on to success as managers elsewhere.
And Don Baylor and Johnny Oates and these, you know, some of these guys, they were managers for, you know, years. And I think that I'm not saying they didn't deserve it, but part of it was the Oriole, you know, the stamp that they had on them. That really helped.
Yeah, so you point out in the book, too, I mean, and this goes beyond 1970, but one thing that you point out in the book is that in the Orioles had the best record in baseball for not just the 70s, which I think is probably not surprising to a lot of people, but also for the 60s. So they were quite successful for a long time with this philosophy.
Yeah, yeah, they always contended pretty much. They had, I think, 17 or 18 consecutive years over 500, which is one of the longest streaks in history. And you know, and then they won a few times as well. And even, you know, the part that you probably are old enough to remember is when you get to the late 70s, when they started to, you know, they didn't deal well with free agency because, you know, they didn't really pay. But they didn't get hurt by that either, because, you know, they would lose these guys and everybody would give up on them, and then they would just plug in new guys and they would keep winning. It was sort of a remarkable thing.
Yeah, I remember, for instance, after 1976, they lost, you know, a number of top-line free agents, including Reggie Jackson, who had been, you know, they had actually traded Don Baylor to get him, and they lost Bobby Grich, and they lost Wayne Garland. And then they just sort of plugged in Eddie Murray and some other guys came along, and they didn't lose a beat. You know, by 1979, right, they were the best team in the American League again.
I think, yes, I grew up a Red Sox fan, and I know that, you know, the Orioles, a lot of Orioles fans, especially who are younger, you know, hate the Red Sox and hate the Yankees and whatever. But let me tell you that when I was growing up in the early 70s, the Yankees and the Red Sox were, you know, the third place. They were battling it out for third every year, and the Orioles were 25 games ahead. So that's what I grew up with. And when the Orioles eventually faded in the late 80s, I was kind of surprised. I mean, it was just like I didn't know how to deal with it.
You and me both. they were like, you mentioned that long streak of 500. They, and I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but that started the year I was born in 1968, and it ended the year I graduated from high school in 1986. So really my entire life up until I went into college, the Orioles were a team that was always above 500. And it was when they started being terrible at that point, it really was hard to deal with, because I just wasn't used to it. You know, the idea that they would not be a good, at least good, you know, they were always at least okay. That was such a foreign idea, but it hit them hard, because they didn't really prepare for the way the team aged. They didn't have the farm system sort of dried up in the early 80s. And I think that was the major issue.
Right.
The title of the book, I think, tells a lot of the story, you know, pitching, defense, and three-run homers, which is, you know, sort of famously Earl Weaver's philosophy for how you win. So that tells you a lot about the 1970 Orioles. But could you just sort of tell us a little bit about what were their strengths? Why were they so good?
I mean, they really could do everything. You know, they were obviously, they had great starting pitching. And, you know, today when you say a team has a great pitcher, you're talking about, you know, 12 people. But the Orioles basically just had great starters, and everybody else was, you know, good enough, because the starters pitched so much. And they had great defense. They won, I think they probably had 4 gold gloves that year, and a lot of these people won gold gloves every year. And they had good hitting, and especially power hitting, with Frank Robinson and Boog Powell and Brooks Robinson, mainly. But Weaver, you know, who was the genius behind it all, I think with all of the famous things that he's sort of known for, which is, you know, eschewing the bunt and platooning and all these things that he did when he had the personnel. I think the best thing that he did was he just knew who to play. He always seemed like he played the right people. One of my favorite Weaver things was what he did with Don Buford, who was almost about to be released at the time that Weaver took over the team in mid-1968. He was a backup infielder on a team that really didn't need a backup infielder, and he had hardly played. And Weaver took over the team. This is very unusual. Bauer was fired at the All-Star game. Weaver took over. And usually when a guy takes over a team, he kind of goes along with the program. And Weaver wasn't like that. He took Don Buford, who's the backup infielder, and he started him the day after the All-Star game. He started him in center field. He let him off. He'd never played the outfield or hardly ever played the outfield in the majors. And he had him hit leadoff because Buford walked a lot, which is something Weaver noticed and no one else did. And he basically became the leadoff hitter for the next 4 years. And Buford was a guy who walked and had power. And you didn't expect that from him because he was a little guy. He was kind of like a Joe Morgan, light. And Weaver saw something in Buford that Bauer did not see. And I think he helped sort of turn the team around. And he did the same thing with, like Ellie Hendricks was a guy that Bauer didn't really care about. And he became one of Weaver's guys, and he was the platoon catcher. And it always seemed like when the Red Sox played the Orioles when I was a kid, that just when you thought you had them, some guy would come up that you forgot that Weaver had, and he would sort of play that extra card that you'd forgotten about just at the last minute, and you'd lose the game.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned Weaver and walks, because it is true. He sort of was a sabermetric guy before that was even a concept. I mean, he understood the value of a walk when a lot of guys in baseball really didn't. On base percentage wasn't something that was talked about in the late 60s. Really, even when I was a kid in the late 70s and early 80s, it wasn't something that was talked about much. But he recognized the value of that. And like you said, he recognized the value of getting guys on base and hitting homers, and that's how you're going to score runs. Forget stealing and bunting and all that stuff.
Yeah, it's like he talked about the home runs. I was never aware of him talking about players walking, but he just played those guys. So he just knew it sort of instinctively. Like, Bobby Gritch is a guy that, sabermetricians sort of discovered, Bill James and people like that started writing about Bobby Gritch in the early 80s. But Weaver, back when he was on the Orioles and he was hitting, 260 with 12 home runs, Weaver was hitting him third in the batting order because Weaver saw what no one else saw, which was that he was a great offensive player. But and I think that probably people watched the games and said, well, I don't know why he's hitting third, but okay, I guess rolls up to something. And it turns out that that's where he should have been hitting. So he was one step ahead of everybody else.
You mentioned defense a minute ago, and one of the things that I always find remarkable about the Orioles of this era is you have, Brooks Robinson, of course, everyone knows about him at third base. You had Mark Belanger at shortstop. You had Paul Blair in center. And, you mentioned Bobby Gritch, who wasn't on this team but would be, the second baseman later on in the 70s for the Orioles. And In the case of Blair and Belanger and Robinson, I mean, not only were they, the best defensive players at their position at the time, they're all in the running for the greatest defensive player ever at their position. I mean, it's pretty remarkable that they produced so many elite defensive players at one time.
Yeah, and I don't know whether that was, design or what, but they certainly had them. And Weaver, as much as he loved, pitching and defense and three-run homers, he became sort of famous especially later for playing, hitters, even more than defenders. He saw the value in that defense, And I think that that was probably a pretty big reason why the pitchers were so good. You know, our perception of guys like Mike Cuellar, as good as Cuellar was, are probably aided by the fact that he was a ground ball pitcher that was throwing ground balls to Brooks Robinson and Mark Belanger. I mean, that was a big part of his skill.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, we've mentioned, you know, Brooks Robinson, Frank Robinson, Jim Palmer are Hall of Famers. I mean, Boog Powell is pretty famous and still beloved in Baltimore to this day because of the barbecue stand and all that. You know, you mentioned Cuellar, McNally, Palmer. That was a well-known part of this team. Weaver, of course. Can you name a player or two maybe who aren't as well-remembered but who were important contributors to the 1970 Orioles?
Well, one of their better hitters in 1970 was Merv Redmond. And Redmond came up in either 68 or 69 and played, you know, quite a bit. But by 1970, Weaver was basically employing all four of his outfielders in the way that kids talk about on the schoolyard. You know, you have like too many players, you say, well, that's okay, we'll just play him on Tuesdays and Fridays and this guy on Wednesdays. And that's kind of what he did. So Redmond, I mean, all four of those guys had enough at-bats to qualify for the batting title. And I think people always think of, you know, if kids are asked to remember the 1970 Orioles or the 71 Orioles, they wanted to name the outfield, everybody would say Buford, Blair, and Robinson. But Redmond played as much as those guys and hit over 320 a couple years in a row. So I think Redmond is the guy. He was a righty, so he always played against lefties. But then he played quite a bit beyond that.
Yeah,
as well.
I mean, this goes beyond 1970, but that kind of approach would become a real Weaver trademark later on, especially like when I was following them in the late 70s and early 80s. He would have all these outfielders, or you know, a lot of more outfielders, but I guess other positions as well, who didn't necessarily play full time, but played enough, like you said, to make a substantial impact. And they would have these crazy numbers, and they'd hit like 320 with 17 homers or something playing part-time. And, you know, I think of guys like, you know, Loewenstein and Reneke and Benny Ayala and Jim Dwyer. He really had a knack for finding guys and putting them in a position to succeed.
Yeah, and I think Rettman was like that, because Rettman could play center field as well. So he could back up everybody. And he could hit, and I think that you went back, you'd probably find out that he never played against the toughest righties. But he played 110. He started like 110 games and pinch hit a bunch of times, and he ended up being a very valuable player. And I think that the key to doing something like that is you have to be willing to piss off your players, which Weaver was never afraid to do, because to get that to work, you have to convince players that they can't play every day, and that's some managers don't want to do that. It's a lot easier to find nine guys and say you're the guys.
I want to ask you about something else, because I know this is in the book, but it's also something I know you're something of an expert at, based on conversations I've had with you in the past about how to put together successful teams. I know you've written a book on that, and you know a lot about that topic. The Orioles of the 1960s, of course, started becoming successful, but it was only after they had been terrible in the 50s, after coming from St. Louis, where they had been terrible forever. And they eventually, got to this point we talked about earlier of the Oriole way and being successful for a long time. We're now facing a period in Orioles history when it looks like things are going to go pretty south pretty fast. And by next year, a lot of the players who are on this team are going to be gone. Perhaps the manager and general manager are going to be gone. They're kind of going to be starting over in a sense. Obviously, the game has changed a lot since the late 50s when Paul Richards was leading the way in turning the Orioles into winners. But what do you think this team needs to do, just in a general sense, to get back on track, given the constraints of being in a small market, and given the constraints of 2018 and where the money comes from and that kind of thing? What do you think, as an organizational philosophy, what direction should they be heading in?
My opinion is that the teams that are sort of, have been successful in recent years in the current, rules about drafting and know, the international bonuses and everything, is that they need to have, it sort of starts at the top, and you need to have the owners hire, you know, smart, you know, front office people, starting in baseball ops, but other places as well, and have them have the leeway to create a great organization, which doesn't happen in a day and doesn't happen in 2 years. And, you know, and start, you know, filling out all those positions, farm director and having everybody on board. And then, you know, there is, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. There's luck involved too. I mean, there's luck in the draft, and you need to draft well, and you need to sign, you know, international, you know, players, and you need to, I don't think free agency is the way to do it, because unfortunately one of the problems that we have today is that none of the free agents want to sign with teams that are developing. They only want to sign with the teams that are already good. So you need to get already good first. And so I would, you know, I would take the slow approach, and that doesn't necessarily mean tanking. Yeah, I would, you know, I mean, if it was my money, I would try and sign Machado and sign Bundy and the young guys. But it just means, you know, trying to build a team for 2022 or, you know, something. But I think, you know, the organization, I don't know enough about the Orioles organization to tell you if they're all on the same page or whatnot, or whether, you know, Duquette is thinking this way already. I can't really speak to that. But I do think that Baltimore has a great baseball tradition. I think they've got a great fan base. And I think that the fan base would I can't speak for the fan base, but the Oriole fans that I know would rather root for a team with young players that had hope than with 32-year-old guys trying to win 75.
Yeah, so I agree with you on that. It's the biggest problem the Orioles have had under the Angelos administration, and I've talked about this on the podcast many times, is there's never really a clear clear strategy, a clear path, a clear process. It's always just kind of every year they kind of make it up, and there's never a, well, this is our five-year plan, this is what we're going to do to get there, and we're going to just stick with our plan. They never stick with a plan because they never seem to really have a plan. And that's the thing that I hope changes when the, you know, if indeed we are looking at big changes in the front office over the next year, I hope that they can come up with some organizational philosophies and stick with them, because that the way they're doing it now is certainly not a recipe for any kind of long-term success.
No, it doesn't seem like it. And I think that, you know, there are people that claim that, well, it's harder to win in the American League East. But, you know, there's been some winnable seasons there lately where there hasn't been a, you know, the Red Sox and Yankees look like they're improving now. But there was a fallow period there where I think that the East was there for the taking. So I think the Orioles can get back. I think every team can. I think everybody gave up on the Astros. Everybody gave up on the Cubs. I think these teams are teams that did have a plan and you know, got lucky a couple times in the draft. But I think even without that, I think they've got organizations that you want to play for.
Yeah, and I mean, in the case of the Astros, they had a couple examples where they didn't get so lucky in the draft. I mean, with those first-round picks, Correa really the only one who's worked out for them.
No, that's right. Yeah, I think that they've got a great development system. They're on the cutting edge in you know, analysis and fielding, and I think that you know, and then when it comes time to get players like, you know, Justin Verlander, you know, to come play for you, you can do it. You know, I think you need to create the good organization, and then you'll get the players.
All right, Mark. Well, thanks so much for being with us today to talk about a much happier era in Orioles history, and we appreciate you being here.
Well, I always like talking to you, Justin, and I've always liked the Orioles. So I wish the organization and you the best of luck.
And that's going to do it for another edition of Locked On Orioles. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.